From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Atlanta by August W. Derleth. I was never one to be hasty in my judgment of others, but I do think that Mrs. Stewart might have paid a little more attention to Maurice. She might have given him the kind of affection he needed. Now that everything is over, there can be no harm in setting down what I know about what happened at that house. Mr. Stewart could not have done any more than he did. He had his work, and sometimes he came out from the city pretty tired. Mrs. Stewart was the one. She was that kind of woman. Lived for herself too much and not enough for others. I don't say that a person shouldn't live for himself, but not alone that. My grandmother used to say that it is much better and richer to love than to be loved. I thought of that often about Mrs. Stewart. I always felt that she never knew what it was to love. Yet, I wouldn't want to say that she didn't love her son. Nobody knows what love is. And love is a great many things to different people. Sometimes love is the most enriching thing in the world, and sometimes it is not. Sometimes it is good and wholesome, and sometimes it is possessive and destructive and evil. Sometimes it is strong enough to live after death, and if love lives after it, then surely hunger and terror and all the emotions of man made strong enough and great enough live afterward too. The Stewarts had taken the house in the Vermont Hills when I joined them. That is, they had moved in for that summer, and they had been there for almost a month when I answered their advertisement for a governess. A great many women simply did not want to take positions so far from the city, which meant really that they wanted to be in the city, because the Stewart house was only about 12 miles from the nearest city where Mr. Stewart had his law offices, and from which he came home almost every night to work over his briefs. Mrs. Stewart was not the type of woman I would have thought satisfied with such a place. She was one of those women who, because they think always of themselves, are apt to get very lonely if there is not someone before whom they can perform all their little vanities. I know it sounds as if I were prejudiced against Mrs. Stewart, but I do not think I was. It's only that if she had been a different kind of person, I don't think anything would have happened. At least, things would not have happened as they did there. I ought to say that the very first time I saw the house, I had a feeling that there was something wrong about it. I know people will say, isn't that just like a woman? But it is true, just the same. After I got to know Mrs. Stewart, I just naturally thought that she was what was wrong about the house. That was a mistake. I know now. Sometimes I wonder if the house was not responsible for some of the things Mrs. Stewart did, or rather didn't do. I really don't have any prejudice against her, poor woman. She is what she is, just as I am what I am, and Mr. Stewart is what he is. And Maurice? The house was really a beautiful house. It was old, a low two-story stone house with a charming roof on which the moss grew green. The stone was yellow, but wet, actually wet outside. That I thought was due to the brook that flowed past outside, for there was a brook, a real Vermont brook, and if you've ever seen those crystal streams with their blue-green water, you will know what I mean. The brook came flowing down from the hills, and right in the center of the grounds around the house, through a little offside beyond the north end, and so behind the house, its former owner had built a deep pool with a fine brick and stone rim curving in an arc toward the brook from both banks. The brook flowed in one end and out the other, and there were trees all along the brook, so that the pool was always shadowed and dark, and one would have thought that there would be fish in plenty there, but strangely enough, there were fish above the pool in the brook, lying under the grassy banks, and there were fish below, but there was not a fish or a frog or even a water spider in the pool. The lilies grew there, and their green leaves and yellow flowers made the water seem all the blacker, and there was a curious illusion of bottomlessness about it when you looked into the water. They told me, that is Mr. Stewart who interviewed me, that Maurice was a problem child, and I came prepared to deal with something like a thoroughly spoiled youngster. Maurice was then 5, or a little older, and he was a singularly beautiful child, with his grave blue eyes, which could sometimes be as merry as the blue water of the brook, racing over the sunlit sand and the rocks in its course, and curly blonde hair, and a sensitive full-lipped mouth. His skin was fair with a good color, and he had an innate understanding of neatness. All that first day, I kept waiting for him to explode into mischief, but it did nothing of the sort. He was quiet, a little shy. He looked into books, he was precocious for his age, they told me, and he behaved very well. I thought it would come the next day, but it did not. And finally, somewhat mystified, I went to Mrs. Stewart and asked her bluntly in what way Maurice was a problem child. Mrs. Stewart was a dark-eyed, thin-faced woman. She seemed to be always a little remote from the present, but she was very clearly a most passionate type of woman, for she held her husband absolutely, and many times he deferred his better judgment to hers, though he never condoned error. She carried on a great deal of correspondence and telephoned friends in the city all day long, and what I held and still hold against her was that she never seemed to find much time for Maurice, even if he was her son. When I asked her, she seemed to be annoyed at once, just as if she should not have had the duty of telling me. "Oh, didn't Wayne tell you?" "No, madam, he did not. I expected a lively, mischievous lad, but I have not found Maurice at all mischievous." "No, if it were only mischief," she sighed, "but it is something much worse. I suppose the best way it is to tell you that he's endowed with an overabundance of imagination." I said nothing. "It is quite distressing for us, but he has fallen into the habit of telling the most barefaced lies, and Mr. Stewart and I feel that he must be broken of it. It is embarrassing for us all to hear him speak before those of our friends who weekend with us, and the worst of all is that there is no explanation for it." "What kind of lies, if I may ask?" She waved one hand about half vaguely, half in a gesture of dismissal. "Oh, all kinds of lies, Miss Carlson. I must admit that I've never liked people who tell lies, though one expects a certain amount of it in children." It was a shock to me to hear that Maurice was addicted to lying. Somehow we're always prone to associate goodness and all the virtues with beauty, especially in children, and I resolved I would do all in my power to break Maurice of prevaricating. The next day I even went so far as to test him. I saw him break a little dish in the kitchen, and carefully pick up the pieces and discard them in the ash can. So I asked him quite casually about an hour later what had become of the little dish, as if I wanted to see if it was something. "I broke it, Miss Carlson," he said candidly. That puzzled me. I reasoned that if he were the barefaced liar his mother said he was, and would certainly have lied about the dish, he did not know I'd seen him. It was very mystifying. and it grew more so as the days slipped on, until the sixth day. That was Saturday, for I came on the Monday of that week. That day Maurice came over to where I was resting on the low veranda on the south side of the house, and said that Alanna wanted to see me. Though I had never seen Maurice with a playmate, I assumed that Alanna was someone from one of the farms nearby. "Bring her here," I said. "Oh no, you've got to go to her," answered Maurice, and held out his hand confidently. "Very well," I said, laughing, and took his hand. He led me around the house quite proudly. I thought his playmate would be out in back, that is, on the upslope of the hill, but there was no one there. Nevertheless, Maurice led the way straight across the yard. I looked all around quickly, but I could see no one. Then we came to the pool. Maurice was accustomed to spend long hours dreaming, and Maurice pulled up my hand and sat down, indicating that I was to sit down too. "But where is she?" I asked. "Do not say anything, please, Miss Carlson." His fair face was flushed with excitement, and I thought his pulse had quickened a little. I put up my hand to touch his forehead, to discover whether he had a fever, but I had barely touched his skin before the most extraordinary thing happened. I felt as if my hand had been brushed aside. The impression was only momentary, it is true, and at the same time, Maurice leaned away a little to look into the water, so that in a few seconds I decided that the illusion had been caused by the boy's movement. I looked around to where the woods came down at the far end of the lawn, half expecting to see a little girl come running out, but there was no sign of anyone. Maurice continued to gaze into the pool with a little smile on his lips. His eyes, though, were somewhat anxious. Suddenly, without a word, he stood up, offered me his hand, and hurried me back to the veranda. He smiled quickly at me, and then hastened back around the house. I was astonished by his action, and took the trouble to walk out from the veranda until I could look back into the lawn, there to see where he had gone. Just as I suspected, he was sitting on the rim of the pool once more, looking into the dark waters, reaching down with one hand. That evening, as I stood beside his bed, I asked him, "And where was your Alanna this afternoon, Maurice?" "You didn't see her," he answered, in a curiously flat tone of her voice, as if he were disappointed. "No, I didn't," I answered. "How does she look?" "Oh, she's pretty." "Is she as pretty as mother?" "Yes." "Where does she live?" "In the pool." So at last I understood what the stewards meant by saying that Maurice was a problem child, that he told barefaced lies. It was not true that he told lies of all kinds, of that I was certain. He had probably told his parents about Alanna, and they had not understood that a sensitive, imaginative child lives in a world of make-believe, and lacking companions in the flesh, is very apt to conjure up imaginary companions. At the moment, I did not say anything. I only smiled at Maurice, but I was instantly resentful that his parents should not have taken a little more trouble to find out what Maurice needed more than anything else was companionship. There was no one, only his mother, the cook, an old gardener who came over from a nearby farm, and myself, with his father in the evenings, all far older than the boy. No one his own age. And since there was no likelihood of there being anyone his own age here for the summer, I knew that I would have to enter his play world with him as much as possible. I went right down to where Mr. and Mrs. Stewart sat in a screened-off porch on the west side of the living room, and asked them whether the boy's imagination was the thing that had caused them to think of him as a problem child. "It is lies," said Mrs. Stewart stubbornly. "I would not call them lies," I answered, just as stubbornly. "The boy is just lonely, and he makes up these things." Mr. Stewart looked up from his papers and observed that it was surely not a healthy sign. He seemed genuinely concerned. "I don't know what you mean by healthy, but it's certainly normal enough." "No, no, it is not," said Mrs. Stewart. "That is just not my opinion alone, Mrs. Stewart," I replied. I don't care whose opinion it is. Maurice has got to be stopped from telling those tall tales, or whatever you want to call them. Her eyes flashed at me. We are depending on you to do what you can. I shall do what I can, but I think it is the worst thing in the world to treat the boy as if he were a liar. I will not do that. We expect you to do things in your way, Miss Carlson, said Mr. Stewart. The issue, you see, was not cleanly forced. It never was. Mrs. Stewart remained emotional about it and annoyed. Mr. Stewart was too far from his daily manifestations, obviously, and I suppose you might say that if I had a more common sense attitude, I lacked imagination in almost the same proportion as Maurice had an overabundance of it. I suppose if I had a little more of it, what happened would not have had to happen. As I was coming up the stairs considerably later that night, I saw Maurice coming down the hall. The hour was almost midnight. There was a clear night with the moon shining, and I wondered what he was doing up at that hour. He could have got himself a drink in the bathroom next to his room, but it was not that. I concealed myself and watched him go by. He went down and out of the house, and I went after him, not making a sound. He went right over to the pool and crouched down on the rim in his white nightgown. And I heard his whispered voice calling, Alana, Alana, in hushed tones. And then suddenly, a little rippling came on the water, a vapor that was not there before. How it startled me. I felt chilled at the sight of it, but it was gone again just as quickly as it had come. There was nothing there, and I began to think my eyes had played a trick on me when Maurice came along with his hand held out and up, just as if he were holding someone's hand, the hand of an older person, and he kept looking up from time to time, as if he were listening to someone walking at his side. I cannot describe my feelings as I saw that. It was uncanny. I saw him quite clearly in the moonlight, but there was absolutely nothing else moving across the lawn, only that curly-headed lad in his white nightgown. But when he went past me, where I stood in the shadow of an old tree near the house, I felt his passage as if a cold wind had brushed me, and once again that feeling of unutterable chill and something of terrible emotional intensity rose up and seemed to cling to me, like something alive, so that I was frightened, almost terrified, by something I could not see or hear. Something less tangible in the wind. That feeling lingered until after Maurice had gone into the house, and it was some moments before I could bring myself to follow him. I went straight to the stairs. He had to go upstairs to his bed, and the moment I put my hand on the stair rail, I withdrew it as if I had touched ice. I might as well have done so, for the rail was wet, wet, and cold. Oh, how cold! And the moment I touched it, I felt the most awful loneliness I ever knew. I felt the most dreadful solitude, as if I were isolated in a place far, far from any human touch or voice, and I felt invaded by the most tearing longing, the most moving desire for someone to hold close to me, someone to possess, to love. It was awful. I wrenched my hand away and fell back against the wall, shaking and trembling. I put on the light, and though I could not touch the stair rail again, I saw the wet gleaming on it all the way up, and I followed it. I saw the wet along the hall and the wall, and I saw it on the knob of the door to Maurice's room. I did not want to touch it again, but I had to know that he was all right. So I leaned forward, bracing myself, and quickly opened the door. The instant I touched the wetness, I felt it again. Oh, the most heart-rending despair, the most pitiful agony, the most utter desolation. Oh, the terrible wanting for someone, someone near, someone to love and adore, someone to belong to and to belong to me. I clung to the door and looked in, but he was there, safe in bed. And I pulled the door shut and drew away from it, shuddering and gasping for such a tearing emotion I had never known, such a cold isolation of the spirit, such a dread and terror and emptiness. It was just as if all the sorrows and griefs of a lifetime had come to life anew and taken away all the memories of compensating pleasures, as if someone were forever doomed to live out his years, far from his kind. Oh, it is impossible to describe it. It was terrible. Whatever they may say of me, I am not a coward. I knew then that there was something horribly wrong about the house. Despite the crying out of every instinct against it, I forced myself to go back downstairs, back out across the lawn to the pool. I sat down the rim and looked into the black water, where now the moonlight lay like silver, and I could see my face looking there up at me out of the dark moonlit water, spectrally. It was beautiful there, with the moonlight all around and the brook talking above and below the pool, and occasionally the sound of fish splashing. I sat there, looking into the pool for 5 minutes, 10 minutes. I do not know what I expected to see there. Certainly, it was not what I saw just as I got up to go. That other thin face, a woman's face, with dark where her eyes should have been, and her light hair flowing wetly down beside her head, so sharp and strong that I thought it was someone looking over my shoulder into the water, and turned, but then there was nothing in the water either, nothing but my own face looking down. But there was something inside me again. Once more, that terrible loneliness, that poignant longing, that incredible hurtful wanting and agonized desolation, which shook me and tore me and set me staggering away from that pool and brought me to my knees in tears. That strong it was, that terrible and moving. I fled to the house and was glad to be in my room, myself once more, save for the trembling and the pity I felt for whatever it was in such desperation out there. I think it was 2 days later that I found the letter. It was stuck in an old album, put into where photographs should have been, and left in a closet off my room. It was 10 years old, in a man's handwriting, and it was addressed to Miss Luella Withers. It was not a nice letter. Lou Alana, I've tried all week to talk myself into coming back and starting over, but it's no use. I'm too weak to do it. I never was much on the noble side of things anyway. So I've taken passage on a tramp steamer for Singapore and the Malay States, which makes it easy for you to get a divorce on grounds of desertion. I want you to have the house. It is really yours. You planned it and all. I am sorry there never was a youngster to share it with us for the little while we were there together. It was rotten luck, but it was our luck. Jack. I put it back where I found it and went down to talk to Mrs. Stewart. I asked her who had lived in this house before. A Mrs. Luella Withers, Miss Carlson. What kind of woman was she? She shrugged. I have no idea. She's dead, of course. The house belongs to some relatives, and we leased it through an agent. She knew nothing at all about Mrs. Withers. I was half of a mind to point out to her there was a curious coincidence to discover that Mr. Withers had called his wife by the same pet name that Maurice called his friend. I should not have asked Mrs. Stewart at all. She said she thought it was not proper to inquire into the habits and the life of the previous tenant of the house. I should have talked to someone else right away. As it was 3 days after that before I managed to take a few hours one afternoon, while Maurice was asleep, to walk down the country road and pay a visit to one of the neighbors. Mrs. Warren was a farmer's wife, well along in years, but still a big, strong woman. She was canning strawberries that day, and I sat in the kitchen with her after telling her who I was. Like most country people, once they have no reason to be suspicious of you, she was very friendly with an ease of manner that made it very pleasant to talk to her. She took me for just what I was, and only asked about the Stuarts in the most casual way, not prying at all, but just wanting to know something about her neighbors, so that it was easy for me at once to come around to the subject of Mrs. Luella Withers. "Oh, yes, I knew her," said Mrs. Warren. "Poor, poor woman." She shook her head, and an expression of sympathy appeared in her warm brown eyes. "Was she unhappy here?" "Unhappy's not in it. She was terrible lonesome. I never saw a woman, nor a man either, that lonesome. She would set and eat her heart out. Her husband got lost on a steamer somewhere. Nobody knows what made him up and take that trip in the first place, and how he wanted a child. I don't know what it was, but I think she was the one couldn't have children. Anyway, if a body took a boy or a girl up along with her visiting there, she never wanted the child to leave. She used to try to keep him there or coax him back. Why, it was something awful the way she carried on. They said the lonesomeness just went to her head and made her thin and hungry looking, and I reckon in the end it would have killed her." "She's dead then?" "Oh, yes. Couldn't stand it anymore. Guess he left her the house, but there wasn't much money. She tried to sell it, but she couldn't. And she couldn't go anywhere else. No money, you see. So on a fine day she up and drowned herself."
"In the pool?"
I asked almost involuntarily.
"Yes.
They say it's deeper than a body thinks." It gave me a queer, helpless feeling to listen to Mrs. Warren tell about Mrs. Withers. "Tell me," I said at last, "did you ever hear her called Alana?"
"That was his name for her. I reckon it's a sweetening name. It's not a name that's in the books, but he would say it was the way a man would talk to a sweetheart, and she would smile and her eyes would shine. So I reckon that's what it was." After that, I felt that the best thing for Maurice would be to get him away from there. I thought it all over that night, and the next morning, before Mrs. Stuart left, I went downstairs and talked to them both at the breakfast table. Maurice was still asleep. I said that I had been thinking everything over, and I felt that Maurice was not lying at all, that his loneliness was responsible for his queer fancies. Perhaps I should have said that I was not sure they were fancies, but I knew that if I had, they would have discounted everything that I recommended, so I could not. I had to hold back part of the truth. They were somewhat put out, but I convinced them. Then I said, "If I make a further suggestion, I would most strongly recommend that Maurice be not told of your intention to leave until it is time to go, or else he may brood about it."
"That is going too far," said Mrs. Stuart. "I will not have the boy growing up a mollycoddle. He will have to learn now that life never gives anybody his way all the time." I felt that the principle was a sound one, but in this case I felt its application would work adversely, and I begged them to reconsider with such earnestness that Mr. Stuart said finally they would think it over, and there the matter rested until the day before they left. Mrs. Stuart had her way after all. True, they compromised. Mr. Stuart thought I was right, but Mrs. Stuart thought she was right. So they compromised by not telling Maurice until the morning of the day before they planned to return to town, and then they told him. We were all sitting at the table that morning, and when they told him, I saw his face. He went all white, and one hand clenched tightly around his fork. "I'm not going," he said in a low voice.
"What was that?"
asked Mrs. Stuart. "I'm not going," he said again. "I don't think you need more than a day to say goodbye to your friend," said Mrs. Stuart coldly. Mr. Stuart coughed. Maurice put down his fork precisely and sat back. "Eat your breakfast, Maurice," said Mrs. Stuart warningly. "I'm not hungry."
"Eat or won't."
Mrs. Stuart looked up with flashing eyes. "You see, first it is lies, then it is disobedience," she said to no one in particular. "It goes from bad to worse, and if he is this way now, what will he be in a few years from now?" Maurice got up and went away from the table.
"Come back here," cried Mrs. Stewart in a voice that was shrill with anger. Maurice never said a word, but simply walked out of the room. Mrs. Stewart would have got up and gone after him, but he held her back. He said brusquely that telling Maurice had been a shock, and it was better to let it work itself out of him without any unnecessary pressure. I was grateful for that, and Mrs. Stewart, after brooding about Maurice's behavior for a few minutes, resumed her breakfast and grew quite cheerful again, as if she had forgotten the entire incident. But I did not forget it. I watched Maurice carefully all that day, and I watched him especially at the pool. I was short with his lessons that day, because I knew he would want to go around and bid his favorite haunts goodbye. He did not say very much, but I could see that he had something on his mind. People often think, particularly adults who have grown far away from their own childhood, that a child's world is dependent upon the world of the adults. But this was never so and will never be true, for a child always lives in his own world, no matter what his circumstances, and a sensitive child never completely forgets that world in his adulthood. I was glad when Maurice fell asleep that night. He had spent a long time at the pool during the late afternoon, and I felt sure that he had been bidding Alana goodbye. So I asked him gently that evening whether he had. "Yes. She doesn't want me to go, and I don't want to go, Miss Carlson. I like her better than Mum. Is that wrong?" "I don't think so, if you keep it your secret." It was a difficult question to answer. "Alana loves me." "Yes," I said with a catch in my throat. "Yes, I'm sure she does. But you can come back sometime and see her again." He looked at me gravely and smiled. "They always tell me I'm lying when I talk about Alana, but you don't, Miss Carlson." "I believe you, Maurice," I said. "Thank you," he answered. I did not leave him until he had fallen asleep, and then I sat up until 1 o'clock in the morning. As it turned out, I did not sit up long enough. I was very tired, for I had helped with the packing, and I fell asleep. It was about 2 o'clock when I awoke, and the waning moon had just reached about tree height in the sky. I do not know what woke me, unless it was the movement of something before my eyes, closed as they were. That is an experience far more usual than is commonly supposed. I had fallen asleep before the window that looked down to the lawn and the brook. The pool lay within easy sight, and the object which had crossed before my eyes was Maurice in his nightgown on his way to the pool. I was fully awake on the instant. I came out of my chair to my knees at the window and called him, "Maurice, Maurice, come back!" But he did not turn. He went straight over to the pool, and he sat down on the rim of it, and I heard his voice, low and soothing, as if he were comforting someone, and then I saw that vapor again, like a long white woman's arm, come up out of the pool and take his hand and pull him into the pool. I screamed, stumbled to my feet, and ran out of the room as fast as I could, down the stairs and across the lawn. But I was too late. Maurice had gone under, and he did not come up again until he had drowned. Even while the others came running from the house, there was something else. While I knelt there at that dark pool, I felt something come out of it and go past me toward the stone house behind, and I saw the grass move in the moonlight, as if two people walked there. And what I felt was not cold. It was not any more that terrible, despairing loneliness. No, it was warm and fulfilling, ineffably beautiful, as if the heart and soul of love itself had become briefly, briefly tangible there and touched me in passing by.